Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 463, an interview with Lucy Commissar about the Saddam Money Networks. This is being recorded on June 6th of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Lucy Commissar, a freelance journalist who has been researching offshore banking networks and who has come across a network that has been used by Saddam Hussein, as well as many others, for many of his transactions. Lucy, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
In discussing the Saddam Money Network, you came across a number of Americans who were involved with moving finances for Saddam Hussein. I wonder if you would review briefly Mark Rich and how he connects up with this particular network.
Yeah. Mark Rich, as many people know, was is an oil man who was pardoned by President Clinton. And the reason that he got in trouble was that he had been involved in illegally buying and selling oil from Iran during one of the embargo periods, but he was on the lam. And in fact, it was the former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani who at the time was a U.S. Attorney who went after him and said that he was responsible for one of the biggest operations of tax evasion in history. When the Kroll Agency investigated the Saddam Network, they found out that one of the people that was helping Saddam was Mark Rich. They found that he was involved in moving the oil, and he specifically, Kroll said to me, and by the way, when Kroll left, fled the U.S., he settled in Switzerland because Switzerland does not consider tax evasion a crime.
You mean when Rich fled the U.S.?
When Rich left, he had invaded more than $48 million in taxes and illegally bought oil from Iran during the 1979 hostage crisis. So he went to settle in a place called Zug, Z-U-G, which is very famous as an offshore center because some of the individual provinces or departments in Switzerland can have laws which afford even tighter corporate and bank secrecy than the country as a whole, and Zug is one of those places where there's bank secrecy even greater than the normal Swiss bank secrecy. So Kroll said, we came up with evidence that through Mark Rich's Spanish subsidiary, he was using some Iranian cutouts, specifically the Bakhtiar family, Iranians, whose family was close to Saddam. He was using them to negotiate arrangements as it related to oil. And this information was turned over to OFAC, which is the Treasury Department's Office of Financial Assets Control. And that means, of course, that the Clinton administration knew that Rich was helping Saddam when Clinton gave him a pardon.
Once again, we want to note that the offshore banking havens that you've been researching for so long, and you're going to be writing a book about that, correct?
I am working on a book on it. I'm putting together a lot of the material that I have collected over the last 6 or 7 years, includes stuff about Iraq, about Al-Qaeda, about the Russians, about the Mexicans, about corporate criminals and drug traffickers, and why the Americans and the rest of the world's financial powers haven't done anything about it.
These offshore banking networks create some very, very strange bedfellows, because, of course, the Iranians and the Iraqis were on the opposite sides of a brutal 8-year war, and yet we find some of these same networks and some of the same individuals dealing with both sides. By the way, we should also mention that Kroll Associates, that's K-R-O-L-L, is a very respected private intelligence and security firm. So when Lucy is sourcing a report from Kroll Associates, she's sourcing a very, very respected information source, indeed, and one that's retained.
I think Kroll was the first. It was the first big investigative agency, and now it's been copied around the world, and you can find companies. Usually they get set up by ex-CIA agents or ex-FBI agents or ex-Justice Department people who know how the system works. But Kroll was the originator of this.
And again, it's a very, very respected source. Some of the other Americans that have been involved with the Saddam money network. Tell us about Roger E. Watson, Lucy.
Well, he's an American Pan-Albanian, dual citizenship, and he helped set up some of the shell companies in Panama that were used by the Saddam network in order to launder money, particularly in order to buy arms during times when you weren't supposed to buy arms, and so they needed Watson for this. Initially, he set up a company called Radistal. The president was Giuseppe Pajoli, who was back in Lugano, who, by the way, had worked with Boridori, who we mentioned on the other show. And they were also offices of a shell company called Duminta, D-U-M-Y-N-T-A. And both of them are listed on documents I have showing kickbacks. That is, big arms companies are sending money or setting up commission contracts with Radistal and Duminta, which, of course, are not real companies. They're just boxes, black boxes, to which to send the kickbacks. So that's what Watson was doing. Then when Al-Mahdi, who had set up the whole system in 1985, was called back to Baghdad because Saddam discovered that there was some money being skimmed out of this system. Based on the documents I was provided, there is some suspicion it might have been some of the Swiss partners, and some of the pointers point to Pajoli, who insists, of course, it was not him. But Al-Mahdi confronted Pajoli with this. There was an audit done, and there were some millions of dollars missing. Al-Mahdi was called back to Baghdad, and there is some feeling that somebody, whoever was the real culprit, might have sent a letter back to, or a communication back to Saddam, pointing the finger at Al-Mahdi in order to get it away from him. So when he went back to Baghdad, he was imprisoned by Saddam, and a year later he was beheaded. 1986, Al-Mahdi was beheaded. So then there had to be a decision about who was going to run the network.
And who did that? Who succeeded Al-Mahdi?
Well, it was that two people, and one of them was Roger Watson, and then also there was more work. There was work done by Aoki, and Pajoli tells me that little by little he moved out of the operation, but they use some of the same shell companies, and then sometimes shell companies change their names. The bank pretty much stayed the Gotardo, it seems, but they tend to change the particulars of the network so that they don't have a paper trail. But in about 1987, what is interesting is that Watson, who became one of the people that took over the network, also went to work as an advisor to Nadmi Aoki. Here you have the same efficient money managers, financial consultants. That's a favorite name for them. Now, who had started out working with Al-Mahdi, and then he became the advisor to Aoki's company called International Company of Banking and Financial Participations.
I'd love some of these names. By the way, one of the points that I want to interject is that if following the various tentacles of this network is difficult for listeners. First of all, the names obviously are not exactly household names. But in talking about Clearstream and talking about these offshore banking networks, these are networks that are not meant to be easily followed. Indeed, they're constructed for the very purpose of evading scrutiny. So if some of this seems kind of hard to follow, that is exactly the point. They're not supposed to be followed. These are created for the purposes of evading scrutiny and law enforcement, and they're meant to be altogether opaque under the circumstances. Another point that I wanted to interject, tying in some of the names and some of the people that we're talking about in connection with the Saddam networks, with some of the people involved with the Al-Taqwa networks. But when Mr. al-Mahdi was beheaded in 1985, he was called back to Iraq, he was beheaded. The al-Mahdi family eventually retained a guy named Gianluca Boscardo to investigate the al-Mahdi networks, the Satan account, and to see if perhaps the al-Mahdi family was entitled to some of these monies. Gianluca Boscardo is mentioned in a paper that I've accessed in many programs. It's called Report on Islamists, the Far Right, and Al-Taqwa by the brilliant Kevin Coogan. And Gianluca Boscardo's law offices were the place where the Bank Al-Taqwa was actually incorporated in 1988. And people like Nasreddin and Yusef Nada, Ahmed Huber, all got together in Boscardo's law offices in order to incorporate Bank Al-Taqwa. And then the al-Mahdi family retained Gianluca Boscardo to investigate the Satan network. Gianluca Boscardo mentioned to colleagues that he feared for his life and that he was afraid that he might be terminated before he could get to unravel this particular tangled web. And then in, late 2002, he was hang gliding and died in a very suspicious hang gliding accident. So
they hired him because he was an insider. His job was setting up some of these networks. He knew exactly how it worked, and they thought, how do you find where the money is hidden in a hidden network? You hire somebody who's been doing that. And he filed lawsuits in Milan, Liechtenstein, and Lugano on behalf of the al-Mahdi family for $18 million in damages against Pajoli and one of his collaborators. There was a lot of evidence because the wife of the widow had been involved in some of the MEDP operations, so they could provide the lawyer with evidence that Pajoli and his colleagues had embezzled from the companies. And as you said, in August of 2002, Boscardo, who was 44, a European hang gliding champion, was killed in the qualifications for the World Hang Gliding Championship, which were being held at Lake Orta in Italy. He was doing a maneuver under the paraglider when suddenly he fell to the ground, and investigators found that the cords had been damaged. So that ended his investigation. Paolo Fusi, the Italian journalist who got the Boscardo files, said that Boscardo had discovered and made the connections between about 30 shell companies and 50 Iraqi accounts in Switzerland.
So, in fact, Gianluca Boscardo had, to a certain extent, accomplished the mission that he'd been commissioned to do by al-Mahdi, by the al-Mahdi family, I should say.
But he wasn't able to carry through because he knew very well what lengths these people would go to. So he died. By the way, there was another, you asked about Americans, there was another person resident in America who was involved in this. He's Lebanese by extraction, so I don't know what his citizenship is. But after al-Mahdi's death, among the people who got control of the network was the Lebanese Alfred Jawde, that's spelled J-A-W-D-E, in New York. And he is still in New York, and I called him. And he won't talk now, but a lot of the documents in the files that I got mentioned Jawde. And again, for the Americans not to know anything about this is rather unusual because it was going on, some of it going on right under their nose because Mr. Jawde was working out of an office on 3rd Avenue in New York City.
Interesting.
And he is still there, and as far as I know, nobody has bothered him, except me, perhaps.
It is interesting to see just how many different bases get touched by some of these networks, and it is truly, in previous discussions, you've spoke about offshore banking and the threat that it presents to America, and indeed it is a major financial repository which is beyond the laws and past a point the scrutiny of law enforcement and fiduciary authorities, not only in this country but many others as well. Lucy, I'd like to touch on some of the specific transactions, because you have a wealth of documentation about some of the specific transactions. I'd like to cover that during the course of this second side of the broadcast. But before we get to some of the specific transactions from some of these weapons dealers, Operation Clean Hands was an Italian judiciary investigation of the endemic corruption in the Italian political system. One of the people who eventually became entangled in some of those investigations was Silvio Berlusconi, now the Prime Minister of Italy. The Clean Hands investigation also came across some of the dealings of the Saddam networks, and I wonder if you would detail what the Italian Clean Hands inquiry uncovered about some of these machinations that were involved with the Saddam network.
They found that our friend Nadim Ialkay again, in 1993, got about $40 million in secret commissions in order to facilitate approval of a French-Italian engineering project to construct a pipeline from Iraq to Saudi Arabia. An Italian banker named Pierfranco Pacini Battaglia told the investigators he got instructions to transfer the commissions to accounts in Panama established in the names of Iraqi officials. So there we go back to Panama, we go back to Saddam. And by the way, there are also some connections between the Italian activities of Ialkay and the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro scandal of Atlanta, which involved the Bush administration. Maybe this is a subject for another broadcast, but he was Ialkay was also involved in that other scandal. According to an Italian parliamentary report in 1987, a Panama company, Dowell, D-O-W-A-L, set up by Watson, was used to collect $23 million in secret commissions on Iraq's purchase of warships from the Italian shipyard Cantieri Navale Riuniti. And there is research to suggest that this was connected to illegal money movements from the Atlanta branch of BNL, the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, the Italian bank, when the then head of the BNL branch in Atlanta testified about this. He said that he had gotten an okay from the Bush administration to move this money on behalf of Saddam.
The BNL scandal was part of the Iraqgate scandal that unfolded in the early 1990s, and again, the elder George Bush was deeply involved with some of these machinations. Yes, let's talk about that in a future interview, Lucy. I was not aware that the BNL scandal directly overlapped the specific topics of this interview. One of the things we should note, too, in terms of taking stock of some of the strange bedfellows, this is not in Lucy's article, but in the aforementioned essay by Kevin Coogan, in the report on Islamists, the far right, and Al-Taqwa, it's mentioned that Perfelice Barchi, about whom Lucy has written extensively, he is the attorney for Youssef Nada. He's also a law partner of Carlo Del Ponte, involved with Claudia Generali and the Banco del Gottardo network.
Yeah, he's the former law boss, because she's not in legal private practice right now. She's the chief judge at the Hague, the trials dealing with Milosevic.
Wasn't she a former attorney general for Switzerland as well?
Yeah, she was the chief. The titles are different, but she was first the chief. You might call it attorney general just for Lugano, and then moved up to be the chief law officer for the whole country of Switzerland. And used her position to basically snuff out investigations that pointed to dirty business going on in Lugano.
And there was a fair amount of that, and touching on a lot of different bases. But Perfelice Barchi had also, as discussed in the essay, report on Islamists, the far right, and Al-Taqwa, also was the lawyer who handled some of the Swiss investments for Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian prime minister, former member of the Propaganda Due Lodge, which, of course, impinges on people involved in the Banco Ambrosiano scandal that we've looked at, Messrs. Calvi and Michele Sindona, whom we discussed in our last interview. And so there's some very, very interesting, strange bedfellows and connections that run between a lot of seemingly disparate elements. Lucy, we've got about 8 minutes left in this side. I wonder, before we discuss, one of the things I'm really fascinated, before we conclude with some of your ruminations on perhaps why it took you so long to get this published. You have a wealth of documentation about some of the specific transactions between major armaments manufacturers and the Saddam network. I wonder if you would just take time and detail a few of those for us, if you would.
Okay. There is, I have, an August 13th, 1990 document signed by International Aircraft Leasing Limited and Airfall Anstalt. Anstalt is a German word which means foundation. Both are shell companies registered in Liechtenstein. And in the document, they talk about, quote, consulting agreements. They talk about past consulting agreements with Airbus Industries in France, March 7, 1985, and with MBB, that's the German company I mentioned earlier. And it says that that's for February 19th and March 18th, 1985, and a contract with Tyson Industries in West Germany, November 1987, and a record of that date sets out commissions from MBB and Tyson totaling $432,000. That's from the August 13, 1990 document. It's sort of it's a look back. It's a bringing up to date of how much money we've got from all of these companies over the past couple of years. And of course, International Aircraft Leasing is just a shell, and Airfell are just shell companies, and they've gotten from MBB, from Tyson, from Airbus, they've gotten $432,000. The UN enacted the comprehensive trade and weapons embargoes against Iraq in 1990, but I have a 1991 Airfell document, that's E-R-F-E-L, again, it's a shell company, which notes 255,875 dollars, which is equivalent to a 5% commission from Airbus, and a $45,247, again 5% commission from Tyson. That's in 1991. They're not supposed to be selling in 1991. Then there's a 1991 balance sheet for IAL, that's International Aircraft Leasing, that's the shell company. And that cites a debt of 1.455 million German marks due Tyson Industries, and then 3,812 French francs earmarked for Kensington Anstalt, which is Almaty shell company. And it's very interesting. I got a call just the other day from a German reporter who I had been in touch with in the past, and he said, did you know that IAL and Kensington were involved in the Helmut Kohl German financing, campaign financing scandal?
Fascinating. The CDU scandal.
Hmm?
The CDU funding scandal.
Yeah.
That by the way, has been...
This is very interesting, and I'm going to look into it more. He asked me for some of what I had, and I sent it to him, and I'm interested in finding out what he has. But, you know, these shell companies, I don't know yet if this will turn out to be the case, but he immediately called and said, this is very interesting what you have found. There was a chart that IAL, again, the shell company, prepared, and on which I have a copy of. It shows that from 1986 to 91, it collected commissions of $1,238,813 Canadian dollars from MBB, the German company, $10,827,000 from Airbus, $3,900,000 Canadian dollars from Tyson, and $1,466 million Deutschmarks from Tyson. And so IAL was getting this money. What for? Well, we don't really know, because it wasn't really a company. It was a shell company, and of course what we do know, what they were getting them for, they were kickbacks. I did contact all of the companies, and I sent them the documents that I had. They declined to respond. In one case, one of the companies said, well, we burned all our papers. One of the French company, we don't keep our papers. After 10 years, we burn all our papers. So we can't tell you anything about that. And the man who's the president now was not the president then. This is too long ago. So these are the documents which show that these big Western arms companies are paying money to shell companies run by the network of Saddam, and they're paying millions of dollars, and it's just a few papers that I have. So we know that there were many more papers that I don't have. Give you an idea.
Quoting Police Chief Louis Renault from Casablanca, I'm shocked to learn that some of these things are going on after the embargo was in place. I mean, it's just one can't imagine. Obviously, I'm being facetious because this is indeed a dirty bit of business, but one that is widely engaged in. Lucy, I'm going to conclude the interview. We've got about 3 minutes left. I'm going to conclude the interview with a speculative element. We've communicated for some time about your research on the Saddam money networks, and you've had this article basically all ready to go, and you had a very difficult time getting it published. I wonder if you're in a position to flesh out the difficulties that you had without impugning any individuals necessarily.
Well, let's just say that this article, that I've had this article for many, many months, as you know, because we've talked about it, and it was shown and declined by, I would say, all of the major U.S. media, the ones that take any freelance writing at all. There are some news magazines that don't accept anything from freelancers, but the big newspapers all have some section, whether it be their magazine or their op-ed or someplace, that take articles from newspapers. And both the mainstream press and, I would say, the left-wing press did not think that it was interesting to publish an article about the Saddam money network and how it connected to the Al-Qaeda money network. And I don't know whether it's because they don't have a clue about the importance of the offshore system. In one case, an editor said, it looks bad when we run outside investigative work because the readers wonder, why didn't our reporters get the story? And some of them asked me if any of the documents I had related to things that were happening pretty much in the present, at least by the late 90s, they didn't seem to think that it mattered that the system was set up and it had been operating for years. And, of course, it turned out now with the oil for food revelations that it was the same countries that were running secret accounts for Saddam. They acted as if something didn't matter if it didn't happen yesterday. And the real reason, unfortunately, is there in this country there is astonishingly bad journalism. The editors like to talk about how the American press is the best, but I don't think so. For example, on a lot of the things that I follow on the international money laundering, the Financial Times, the FT, is much better than any American publication. Much better, hands down.
Indeed.
I can read it on the Internet, so I know that because I read it every day. Much better. So the American media is just not very good.
Indeed, and listeners to this program, longtime listeners, are very familiar with the Financial Times, which I've accessed for many, many years, so I certainly second your opinion. By the way, Lucy, we're going to be wrapping things up now. Where can people access your UPI interview?
Oh, well, let's see. It's on their website, but I don't know whether it's all available because they're now selling things. I guess you have to do a Google. I do have a link, which is rather complex and which I will give you to put on your website.
Okay. We will have it linked in the description for the record program number 463. Eventually, this program will be on streaming real audio on www.wfmu.org. That same website is already streaming For the Record's 458 and 387, two of our previous interviews with Lucy Commissar. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 463, interview with Lucy Commissar about Saddam's financial networks. Lucy, I want to thank you for appearing with us once again.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
For Lucy Commissar, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.